Thank you, Ms. Joyce. We're going to be in the book of Psalms today. The book of Psalms. The Bible is filled with joy all throughout it, and especially the book of Psalms. And one of the things you'll notice as you read through the book of Psalms is that joy shows up throughout the book in many of the different songs that are written in spite of what's going on. There's a lot of ups and downs with the psalmist, but this consistency and this constancy runs through all the different chapters, whether it's David or Asaph, that there is this sense of rest, regardless of what the circumstances are. Joy transcends the circumstances, the psalmist thinks, because God transcends the circumstances. And so in the Lord, we can find joy no matter what. A lot of different instances that show that. Psalm chapter 5 says, "Let all those that put their trust in thee rejoice. Let them ever shout for joy, because thou defendest them. Let them also that love thy name be joyful in thee." Psalm 16 says, "Thou wilt show me the path of life, and in thy presence is fullness of joy. At thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore." Psalm 43 says, "I'll go to the altar of God, unto God my exceeding joy. And upon the harp will I praise thee, O God, my God." Chapter 89, "Blessed is the people that know the joyful sound. They shall walk, O Lord, in the light of thy countenance." The New Testament confirms this truth as well, that God himself and a close relationship with God is the source of joy and the wellspring of life. John 17, when he prays for his disciples, he says, "Now I come to thee, and these things I speak to the world, that they may have joy fulfilled in themselves." Romans 14 says, "The kingdom of heaven's not meat or drink." It's not things you do or your standards that you have. It's righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Ghost. 1 John 1 says that he wants us to have fellowship with God and with the other believers. Our fellowship is with the Father and his Son, Jesus Christ. Verse 4, "These things write I unto you, that your joy might be full." And that's just a smattering, everybody in here knows, of a few of the many, many places where he emphasizes joy. Now the Jewish people, the reason the Psalms really exist, the Jewish people were a singing people. Singing was very important to them. Music was very important to them. And they embedded it in their culture and also at very pivotal moments in their life. So remember when the nation of Israel that got out of Egypt, they crossed the Red Sea. And then the very next chapter you read in Exodus is an entire chapter of a song that they write. That's a funny thing. Have you ever thought about that? Everybody stop. Get out your instruments. We're writing a song. And that's what happens next. Now, whether they did it at that moment, I don't know. It's just interesting that it's tossed right there. Same thing happens in the book of Judges. They go up, Deborah and Barak, they go up, they fight against the Canaanites and Sisera and their army, and they defeat them up north in Hazor, and they come back down, and Deborah and Barak, in Judges chapter 5, they write a song. And they're a little bit trash-talking in that song, too. You can go back and read it. But they write a song. They're singing people. But not only because they want it to be, but because they're also commanded to be. Because the book of Psalms not only displays their joy in their music, it also commands music with the joy in it. Psalm 147 says, "Sing unto the Lord with thanksgiving. Sing praise upon the harp unto our God." Do that. Psalm 149, "Let them praise his name in the dance. Let them sing praises unto him with timbrel and harp." So it's appropriate that we find that because joy comes from God alone, some of the most consistent songs they would sing was when they would go to God's presence. Near the end of the book of Psalms, you're going to see 15 chapters all right in a row that are all called a song of degrees. Have you ever noticed that? That section right there? A lot of Psalms have a little bit of a prescript, and they'll say, David, when, you know, Absalom, his son, push them out of town. Song of Asaph, a song of the sons of Korah. You have 15 psalms that are called the Song of Degrees. The idea of that is levels of ascending. The Jewish people in the Old Testament law, they had many feasts that they had to keep throughout the year. They had to keep Passover, and then immediately after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, they kept Pentecost and the Feast of Tabernacles and the Feast of Trumpets, and so a lot of different things. Several times during the year, the Jewish people were not supposed to celebrate that feast at home. They were supposed to celebrate the feast in Jerusalem. And so people from all over, later on during Jesus' time, the world, all over the world, but before, all over Israel, they would all travel to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was on a hill. And so no matter which direction you came, north, south, east, or west, you would walk up to Jerusalem. And it was a very beautiful picture of we're going up to the presence of God. And they would sing these songs of degrees. These were the songs you sing on the way to Zion. We're going to the temple. We're going to God's presence where he lives. Psalm, I want you to turn to Psalm 122. And they're always filled with this sense of rest and peace and joy. And there's a lot of nostalgia woven throughout it because no matter what happened that year or last 6 months, you know, what bad things happened, we're God's people. God's still with us. He's here at the temple. We're going to go see him. We get to put our life aside for a week and celebrate what God has done and what he's doing. Psalm 122 is one of those songs of degrees. I was glad when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord. Our feet shall stand within thy gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem is builded as a city that's compact together. Whither the tribes go up, the tribes of the Lord, unto the testimony of Israel to give thanks unto the name of the Lord. There are set thrones of judgment, the thrones of the house of David. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They shall prosper that love thee. Peace be within thy walls, prosperity within thy palaces. For my brethren and companions' sake, I will now say, peace be within thee. Because of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek thy good. Flip a couple pages down. I want you to look at one more. Psalm 132. This is another song of degrees. The Lord hath chosen Zion. He's desired it for his habitation. This is my rest forever. Here will I dwell, for I have desired it. He desired it for his habitation. I desire it too. Verse 15, I'll abundantly bless her provision. I'll satisfy her poor with bread. I will also clothe her priests with salvation, and her saints shall shout aloud for joy. There will I make the horn of David to bud. I have ordained a lamp for mine anointed. His enemies will I clothe with shame, but upon himself shall his crown flourish. Can you just imagine the fun that would have been? All the families and the little kids, and they all knew these songs, and you would sing them as you skipped up the road on the way to Jerusalem for the feast this year. God wanted them to be filled with joy, but not only that, he wanted them to be filled with joy from him. The joy that's woven throughout the Bible is a joy that is found when we are in his presence. Now, some of you might remember this a long time ago, but when he talked about when we were going through the book of Revelation, we talked about the definition of the word Zion. Zion, really, if I were to encompass the way the Bible uses this term, it's simply this: where the presence of God is. Sometimes the Bible refers to Israel as Zion. Sometimes to Jerusalem, sometimes to like the temple spot. And there's always a connection between we're going to Zion where God is, to see the temple, to see him. This is our homeland because it's God's land. And so, it's appropriate that going to Zion, marching to Zion, is always associated with joy and peace and rest, regardless of the circumstances. However, we know, if we know our Bibles, that did not last for the nation of Israel, did it? See, they were supposed to find fulfillment and peace and rest in God, but they chose not to. They chose to find fulfillment in the pleasures of this world, idolatry, materialism, selfishness, whatever it might be. They had replaced God in their life. And yet, they still wanted Zion, right? They still wanted Jerusalem. They still wanted the walls to stand. They still wanted the temple. They still wanted the namesake of their patriotism as God was pushed out of their nation at the same time. But to have the presence, the blessings of God without the presence of God is a contradiction in terms. You cannot have Zion without God. because God is where Zion is the place, I'm sorry, Zion is the place where God is. They had chosen over Zion the pleasures of this world. They had chosen over God's presence the pleasures of Babylon. And so, if we know our Bibles, to Babylon they would go. Now, my message tonight, I wanted you to see all of those very quickly, briefly, as we went by, because I want you to see the joy, especially in this part of the book, so that we can fully appreciate the psalm we're about to read. I want you to turn to Psalm 137. Maybe the saddest psalm in the book. In fact, it is almost too harsh to be believable. So much so that it's recorded that a group of Anglicans back in the 1980s, it was part of their liturgy to read a psalm every time they would gather together on Sunday. And they would read a psalm. They deleted Psalm 137 from their list because it seemed inappropriate to read on a Sunday morning. You think, let's all get together and read Psalm. And so we read one, like the ones we just read. What an encouraging way to start the day. They were like, Psalm 137 doesn't do that. Let's not put that one in. And they skipped right over it. It's like, wow, that's horrible. Well, let's read the psalm, shall we? Verse 1. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it even to the foundation thereof. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones. The end. Now, some psalms, when you read them, it's like, wow, harsh. And then there's this midway point, right? Where there's this turn of trust and, but, oh, Lord, I know that you are in the heavens. Like, that's verse number 10. There is no verse 10. It stops there. Most psalms, even when they are very difficult, and you can hear in maybe David or Asaph's voice this frustration and this anguish and this almost annoyance that things aren't seeming just, often there's a lot of things consistent throughout the psalms. There's a recognition of God, usually at the beginning, oh God, I know that, and then he lays his complaint. This psalm doesn't have that. There's often a confession of trust in the Lord somewhere in the middle, if there's a bad circumstance somewhere at the beginning. This psalm does not have that. Usually there's an element of praise at the very beginning or at the very end or both. This psalm does not have that. So though I still chide the Anglican Church for saying, no, we don't need this psalm, at least the very few of us can understand why we might think of all psalms as would be a hard one to start Sunday morning. Imagine that. Let us read the reading for today. Happy is he that dasheth thy little ones against the stones. Good morning, everybody. You know, so I understand. But throughout the Bible, what I love about this psalm is that it really plays right into an archetype that the Bible gives us from beginning to end, all the way to the very last book, between Zion and Babylon. God's presence, and the place that is without him. And it pictures it as cities, the place where people dwell in. where people choose to move into, they choose to move out of, and where they live. And the Bible lays at our feet this responsibility and to evaluate ourselves, where is it that you dwell? In Zion or in Babylon? You see, as you look and you can hear the anguish in these people's voice, the only people more wretched than the ones who already live in Babylon are the ones who used to live in Zion. And they remember its joy, but they do not have it. There's a lot of Christians who don't live in Zion, and they do not have joy, because they want the blessings of Zion without God's presence. They want to live in Babylon and then march to Zion on Sunday morning and sing the songs of degrees on the way there. I'm sorry. When you're living in Babylon, you have to hang up your harp, because you're not going to have the joy that the Bible shows you that's woven throughout it. All that joy and all that presence is always attached to what God has done and who God is and how we experience him in our life. And it's always detached when we don't have that. And so from probably the saddest psalm in the book, I want us to give us four truths about trying to sing the songs of Zion when we live in Babylon. So point number one, the first one's easy. You probably already knew I was going here. Number one, you cannot sing songs of Zion when you're living in Babylon. You cannot. Let's go back to the beginning. Verse number one. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there they that carried us away captive required of us a song. They that wasted us or tormented us or oppressed us required us of us mirth. Mirth is an interesting word. It's not, to say joy is a little bit too lean for that word. It kind of has the idea of to party with joy, where there's this frivolity, this holy, just, you know when you get together, okay, Christmas Carol, like the movie, The Christmas Carol, and where Scrooge goes back to his old life and they're having that big party at whatever his face is. What's his name? Does anybody remember his name? Somebody, huh? Yes, Fezziwig. Remember that scene or that part of the book where they go to the party and they're there and they're dancing, and then even Scrooge kind of comes out of his shell in his flashback. That's the idea of mirth. It's just this happiness and this joy and everything's good and we're just rejoicing for the moment. He says they required that of us. We don't have any of that. They required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. And how shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? It's hard to say whether the Babylonians asked them to sing one of their folk songs that was supposed to be an indicator of their joy out of a sense of mockery or simply out of a genuine curiosity. I don't know. But the point remains that they could not, because verse 2, they had already hanged up their harps. Remember throughout all this, sing the song, get out your harp. And it's like they purposely go to this place and they hang it. I cannot sing. I'm not where I am supposed to be. They knew where they weren't supposed to be. It wasn't that they were unaware that they shouldn't have been in Babylon. They knew this is not where they belonged. And so they knew they did not have joy. We choose between Zion and Babylon every day. My Sunday school class, by the way, should already be aware of this. Light, darkness. God, the world. Christ, Antichrist. Sinning not, sin. And we choose where we dwell and where we abide. And the entire picture of the city is very appropriate. This is a choice that we make. Psalm 91 says, "He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty." You will experience the blessingness of that place when you live there. If you don't live there, you don't get the ramifications of living there. You don't get the consequences of living here. You don't get the benefits of living there. You cannot have Zion's joy when you're living in Babylon. And at least they knew that. This might be where you physically choose to move your family, closer to God's plan or further away from it. It might be where you choose to go throughout your week, whether you choose to prioritize going to places where Babylon is or where Zion is, whether church is a priority in your week or not. It might be what you individually choose to do with your time, what you dwell in. The stuff of this world or the things of Jesus Christ. It might just be where you dwell in your mind. God or in the world. This has a million applications to you. But as you dwell in Babylon, you won't have God's song in your heart. Often we are unaffected and unconcerned. We begin to notice it when our song stops, though, and we have no joy or peace anymore. But it matters what's going on in our heart. One of my commentators told a story of John Albert, who was known as the Stradivarius of America. He was a violin maker. He died at the age of 90. But his great success in making violins was not only his craftsmanship, but also his obsessive importance he put on what kind of wood he used. He actually laid in the hospital for several weeks at one time because of an injury that he had, because he was in a specific impassable forest trying to get to a very specific kind of wood so he could make his next violin. Because it was important, not just that it made music, but what it was made out of so that it could make the right music. My commentator tells that story and he says this: "Surely if a violin maker must pay such great heed to the character of the wood out of which he constructs a violin in order that he may make it a perfect interpreter of musical thought to human ears, we should not wonder at the care of God in seeking to so purify and cleanse our hearts that they shall be resonant and responsive to the slightest touch of the Holy Spirit, and thus be able to interpret the melodies of heaven." Is your violin made out of the right wood? I'm not asking if you like hymns or if you're a good singer. I'm asking if you have joy that you know that you should have, or the joy that maybe you used to have but don't anymore. You cannot sing Zion songs when you're in Babylon. Number two. The remedy is not to fake a song. The remedy is not to fake a song. They asked them to sing one of the songs of Zion, and they just simply refused because they had already decided there was no reason to sing. That's what he says in verse 3 and 4. "They that carried us away captive required of us a song. They that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. But how shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land?" What were they supposed to do? Sing one of the songs about going up to the temple? And they weren't there? It seems wildly inappropriate for them to sing a song of degrees traveling back home to their land in Babylon, instead of traveling up to the temple where they know that song was supposed to be sung. So at least I'll give them a little credit, because they didn't just put a song on for the sake of it, to appear where they were okay when they really weren't. So my wife, she does this really annoying thing. She refuses to be fake. Now, that's great, but, you know, we don't really argue, but sometimes we're not on the same page. And sometimes we're not on the same page immediately before we get to church. Now, you know what you're supposed to do when that happens? You're supposed to act like everything's okay. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what everybody else in here does, right? That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to get out of your car and act like you have just had a conversation about the Bible and you're in love with each other more than you ever have been. That's what you're supposed to do. Everyone knows that. But when she gets out and we're maybe not quite on the same page, she doesn't quite like put on the fake smile that everyone's supposed to have. And she says, well, it's because I don't want to appear fake. So she's not, you know, sitting as close to me as she normally is. And I was like, come on, you know, get it together. But here's the thing. This is how we often live our Christian life. We're not where we're supposed to be, but we know exactly how to slather it on when we get into church. We're not actually good Christians. We don't live in Zion, but we know how to sing the Song of Degrees as if we're marching to Zion when we're not. The remedy to what's going on in our heart is not to act like we're okay. Too many Christians have remedied the obvious problem of living in Babylon by picking up their harps and singing like they live in Zion when they aren't. And they think that that counts. Well, everyone thinks I'm okay, so I still get to check the box. You cannot truly have the joys of God's goodness, his blessedness, answers to prayer, peace that you're supposed to have when you dwell with him, when you aren't dwelling with him. Faking Zion's song is not the answer, and at least they knew that. Number three, we are prone to stay in Babylon. And we should know that. We are prone to stay in Babylon. I want you to notice a couple very, very subtle hints. Now, most of this point comes from verse 5 and 6, but I want you to notice a couple very subtle things. In verse 1, he says this, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. And then in verse 2, he says, we hanged our harps on the willows. Now, that might not mean a whole lot to you, except for the fact that, see, Babylon is known. The area where Babylon was, that place, there's a debate that's completely unnecessary to have here about where exactly the rivers are. Is it the rivers like a singular plural where it's one river and I'm just talking about the waters in the river? Or is it that I'm talking about both rivers of Babylon, Tigris and Euphrates, and I'm somehow living in between them? It doesn't matter. Here's the point. That whole area of Babylon was actually very lush. It was very fertile. It was in very stark contrast to the rocky, deserty cliffs of Judea. And so when they arrived in Babylon proper, it's green here. They had willows growing. There's already this sense of, well, maybe this is an okay place to stay. But see, they recognized already that it was possible that they would get to that point. Look at verse number 5. They say two things. They basically pronounce a curse upon themselves. If they forget where they came from. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. Now, those two curses are not arbitrary. My right hand forget her cunning, my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. This whole psalm is about singing and making music, which you usually need a right hand of skill to play and a tongue to sing. And so they said, if I ever get to the point where I forget Zion and I choose to stay here, I wish upon myself that I will never have a song again. Now, why would they bother saying that? Obviously, they're never going to forget where they came from. Obviously, they would go back the first chance they would get, right? But I think they saw in themselves, they got there. Maybe it wasn't so bad as they thought. One of my commentators mentioned, materially, the Jews actually lost little or nothing by having to migrate to Babylon. They weren't actually slaves the same way they had been in Egypt. They were prosperous colonists. And we know that even from Jeremiah. He says, now you're going to have to go there. Plant a vineyard, build a house. Remember that? They were prosperous colonists. Some of them were so well-to-do, so contented, that they let Zion and Jerusalem slip from their minds. And yet there was ever a remnant whom no material prosperity could ever satisfy, who said, Better a cottage in a vineyard in Jerusalem than a palace here. But they were worried that they would forget Zion altogether. And hey, we all know, not all of them left. An opportunity would present itself one day where they could leave and pack up from Babylon and go home. And not all of them took it. Because they built a house and a vineyard by the rivers of Babylon. And the willows sat outside in their backyard and it was pretty. And they forgot where they came from. Listen, we are prone to stay in Babylon. If you are not where you're supposed to be and it bothers you, it's a good thing. What's dangerous is when it stops bothering you. See, these people are in a bad spot right now. At least they're saying, I never want to fake a song or have the song of Babylon in its place. I never want to forget where I came from. And they're sitting and they're weeping and there's no joy, there's no trust, there's no praise in this song, but at least they know that. And they say, I hope I never forget to go back to where I should be. But a lot of Christians have forgotten. And the moments come and go throughout the Sundays, throughout the Bible conferences, throughout the Wednesdays, throughout the moments in their life. And they choose to stay in Babylon. And every time they choose to stay, they further forget Zion. And they replace Zion's songs with Babylon's songs instead. We are prone to wander. Someone said, the soul of man is, after all, finite. When the soul is filled with this world, there is really no room for the next. The regenerate soul may be carried captive. Some of us must know too well into this Babylon of deadly sin. It may be carried captive. It may at once make its escape and return. And happy are they with whom it fares thus. But supposing the soul is detained in Babylon, supposing habits of evil are formed, and the enfeebled will is held down by bolts and bars which it cannot break, then how is it to sing the Lord's song? How is it to mount upon the wings of desire and hope to the throne of the All-Holy, whose law it the while sets steadily in defiance? How can we sing the praises of our Maker if we have not reason to be thankful to him for the gift of an undying existence, or the praise of our Redeemer if our hearts do not tell us that we have been washed with his blood and have not defiled our garments, or of our Sanctifier if we know that we have grieved him and that he has taken himself from us? Take heart in this small consolation. If you're not spiritually where you need to be and you're aware of it, if you have no joy and it bothers you, take heart that at least you have not forgotten Zion. That was what they were afraid of. Be afraid of that. No, you cannot have Zion's joy if you live in Babylon, but at least do not try to replace the joy with the joys of Babylon. And that takes me to the last one, number four. When we live in Babylon and we have no songs of joy, we often sing songs of curse on other people. When we live in Babylon and we have no songs of joy, we often sing songs of curse on others. Now, this whole psalm is already sad enough, but then it kind of escalates very quickly once you get to the end. So let's turn to one of the passages that everybody wants to read over during their daily Bible reading and just ignore it and go right on to the really next happy ones that follow, right? Verse number 7. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it even to the foundation thereof. He points to somebody else. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stones. Some have mentioned that this last little grouping, it's almost like a song. They had no songs of joy, so they decided to make this song instead, in its place. Now, there's a lot to say about this passage. I'm going to say probably about three major things about it. Before I get to the first one, though, it's really interesting how he kind of turns on its head a motif you see throughout all the book of Psalms, which is blessedness and happiness. You know how that starts. Blessed is the man that, right? Chapter 1, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, standeth in the way of sinners. Psalm 84, blessed are they that dwell in thy house. They shall be praising thee, Selah. Blessed is the man whose strength is in thee. Verse number 12, O Lord of hosts, blessed is the man that trusteth in thee. And what they do is they steal that theme, they toss it in here in the end. Happy is the man, happy shall he be, that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be, dashes thy little ones against the stones. All the other ones, joy is found in the Lord. Joy is found in vengeance, they say here. And then period, the end, done. This is an imprecatory psalm. It's probably, it may be one of the worst ones in the book. This psalm is considered one because what it is when the psalmist prays for justice on his enemies. And you will find several of these throughout this book. Edom, by the way, was, we know this from both Jeremiah and from several other places, depending on where you date Obadiah. Nobody actually really knows for sure. But we know that Edom stood by. They had a really mixed relationship with Judah and Israel, usually not very good. And Edom stood by and wished the destruction of Israel when Babylon came. And here they just narrate that briefly. And so he points at them and says, God, they sat by and they cheered on the Babylonians to raise Jerusalem to the ground. And then he points at Babylon, and God, they were the ones who came, and they were the ones who took us. Edom wished their destroying. Babylon, of course, did the destroying. Now, several things to say about imprecatory psalms, because like, you can't read this psalm and not address this obvious thing. Many of the imprecatory psalms throughout the book are actually written by David. And if we know his life and we know his story, he was not actually a very vengeful person. And he had a lot of opportunities to take vengeance and chose not to take it. You're going to have those moments where you just want wicked people to fail. And we're going to sound spiritual. I want wickedness to fail. I want evil to leave. You want them to fail sometimes. And that's what wells up in your heart. And it bothers you when injustice is done. And it bothers you when you're on the receiving end of it. You know the best thing to do with all that emotion? Because you're going to have it, by the way. The best thing to do with that emotion is take it to God. So the Psalms teaches a very important lesson. When we have all that animosity towards injustice welling up inside of us, and all of us have felt that, what should you do with it? Take it to the Lord. And if you're like David, you let God take care of it and not you. Vengeance is mine, I will pay. Therefore, we are released to, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirsts, give him drink. So the Psalms are an expression of our heart. And sometimes we feel this way. What should you do with that? Take it to the Lord. So that's good in that regard. And even though this last statement specifically about the young ones is so horrible, the fact is the prophets actually already said that those things would happen to Babylon. Jeremiah says Babylon would fall, and it would fall hard. Isaiah says of Babylon, their children also shall be dashed in pieces before their eyes. Their houses shall be spoiled and their wives ravished. So what they are saying here is something that they probably already knew from the prophets, was already said about Babylon falling. Many have mentioned that it's very, very, very likely that they wrote this psalm in Hebrew. And they're living in Babylon, who all spoke Chaldean. They compared it to the songs of the slaves that they would sing in the American South, where sometimes they would sing songs that only really they understood. And they would sing them as almost to speak to one another, and the masters didn't really understand what they were talking about. It's possible that this psalm was written in Hebrew so they could sing it in Babylon about Babylon falling, and the Babylonians didn't really know what they were talking about. Oh, they're just singing one of their songs. No, they weren't. And it's true. God will judge wickedness. All the things in the imprecatory psalms are actually reality. Those who are evil, those who are unjust, those who are wicked, those who raise themselves up against God and his people, they will fall. So that is true. But what I noticed first when I read this is that somehow they managed to find all the fault in Edom and in Babylon. It's as if they completely slipped their minds. The reason they were in Babylon in the first place was because they walked away from God. And while their anger against Babylon is not technically incorrect, it may just be misplaced. Babylon is evil. Babylon will fall. The things they said are quite horrible, but they already knew they would happen. But all of the anger that they had, they managed to deal with their bad situation by laying all the blame on the worldly people being worldly. W.E. Barnes says, they thought upon the wrongs, but not upon the wrongful dealings of Zion. Zedekiah's broken oath to the king of Babylon, their own intrigues with the enemies of Nebuchadnezzar, they're all forgotten. Yet the destruction of Jerusalem and the joys of their neighbors on the day of destruction, they were remembered too well. Now, why do I say all this? When our lives are falling apart spiritually, what often happens is that although there are evil people out there who will be judged by God for the evil of their doing, we fail to point the fingers at ourselves and how we have played a part in what is going on around us. Well, what about Babylon? Well, what about Edom? And so many carnal Christians rest in their broken situation by finding somebody to point fingers at. And the reason why it's easy to point fingers at them is because everything we say about them is right. Well, they are evil, and they will fall, and they are bad, and God will judge them. And so since everything is right, we think this is the appropriate response to our issue. Well, what about the Democrats? You know, well, what about the transgender community? Well, what about my neighbor? What about my family? What about you? You're not supposed to be in Babylon. Babylon was evil before you got there. It'll be evil after you're done. But you're there because you've chosen to be there. And listen, Babylon's not always out there. Babylon is where you choose to live. Perhaps the vengeance that we should have is on the Babylon in our own hearts. Remember in 2 Corinthians, Paul had written the book of 1 Corinthians, and he's quite direct about all their issues, of which there were many. I just outlined the book of 1 Corinthians for my Bible class this week, and I said, it's very hard to outline. It's not a logical progression. It's just a big list of a bunch of stuff they were doing wrong. And next. And he goes to the next one. And he gives them all these things, and he tells them, deal with it. And they did. In 2 Corinthians chapter 7, he says, behold, the selfsame thing that ye sorrowed after a godly sort. What carefulness it wrought in you, what clearing of yourselves, yea, what indignation, what fear, yea, what vehement desire, yea, what zeal, yea, what revenge. In all things ye have approved yourselves to be clear in this matter. All the zeal, all the vehement desire, all the clearing, all the carefulness, all the revenge, he says, was on their own bad choices. And he says, and that was good. Long ago, C.S. Lewis actually writes about this psalm. And what he points out about this is the Babylon that lives in each one of us. And perhaps one way we could apply this psalm is maybe not wish that we dash the little ones of Babylon against the stones out there. Perhaps we should be willing, and our appropriate response should be, to dash the Babylonian evil in our hearts. And he says this, and blessed is he who can, because it is easier said than done. So where are you tonight? Have you allowed Babylon to take you captive? You're in church on Sunday. That doesn't matter. You're in church on Sunday night. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have a statistically higher likelihood of not being pulled by the fleshliness and the desires in this world. You can march into Zion with a fake song and then go back and dwell in Babylon during the week. You're not doing it very well, but you can fake it. A lot of Christians, they think the Christian life is learning how to convince everybody else around them they have a joy that they don't have. And if they have that, then they have been successful. If you're living in Babylon, you're not going to have the joy that you need. So ask yourself the simple question, do I have the songs of Zion in my heart? If you don't, The songs of Zion in your heart come when you dwell in Zion. If you're not dwelling in Zion, you're not going to have its songs. If you don't have its songs, you're not where you should be. That means you're living in Babylon. And we have to recognize how easy it is to go there and to stay there. For those of you who have God's joy in your heart and you're living and you're rejoicing in Him, Babylon's pool is always there. And it has rivers and it has trees and it has wealth and it has ease and it is always pooling on us. And it's easy not only to go there, it's easy to stay there, and it's easy to forget where we were. But if you're going to have a song of vengeance, don't have it on all those failing around you. Have it, like the Corinthians did, on the sin in your own heart, so that you can go back one day to where you should be and rejoice for what God is doing now. You can't sing the songs of Zion when you're living in Babylon.